Yes, there was the Democratic Convention this week and lots of politics. And also, yes, the post office and lots of other kinds of politics. Might I humbly suggest, though, the economy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday today, the 21st of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Lots to get to as we consider the past 5 days in this economy. Not a whole lot of time, so we are going to dig right in. Catherine Rempel is at the Washington Post. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, let me start with you and a column you had in today's paper and an accompanying tweet that, honestly, I don't remember if it was this morning or this afternoon, but the gist of it was, what we have here is an economic recovery on top of a depression. Talk about that a little bit.
You basically have two separate economies right now. And actually, my colleague Heather Long had written about this last week, so I want to give her credit for that. But basically, you have these two different economies. You have the economy of higher income, white collar, more likely to be college educated people, people who can still work from home, as I can, who can get delivery for most needs and desires, and basically are in a recovery right now. In fact, if you look at the jobs data for people in the highest income quartile, all of the jobs that were lost in the spring have been recovered. And then you look at people in the other economy, people who are more likely to be working class. They have jobs where they have to physically show up in person, you know, at retail stores, at gyms, at restaurants, hotels, et cetera. And they are still deeply, deeply struggling. Those jobs are still missing, essentially. And you have this divergence in other kinds of indicators, too, right? In terms of home sales, for example, existing home sales are way up, as we've learned. Meanwhile, mortgage delinquencies are way up as well. So you have these very divergent experiences depending on who you are, and also, of course, reflected in the stock market as well.
Yeah, we'll get to the market in a minute because that is obviously related. But Sudeep, I want to turn to the political part of this, actually. And I wanted to talk to you about the polling that's out there that shows Vice President Biden leading President Trump in most areas. But when the question turns to handling of and trust to handle the economy, President Trump comes out ahead. Discuss.
You know, I remember seeing all of this 6 months ago, and I thought, yeah, that kind of makes sense. The wage growth is strong. The stock market's up. I can see how people would see that. Trump has marketed himself as a businessman. Biden's marketed himself very differently. What's was puzzling now is how is that possible at this moment when we are in what could be considered a depression? Obviously, the market's back up, and that's made a difference. But there is just a certain group of voters, fixed Trump voters and fixed Biden voters who aren't going to change their views. Trump famously said he could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and not lose any voters. And that seems to be what is happening now. Trump has somehow managed to take what he was criticizing before, a lot of the same dynamics in markets, the big fat ugly bubble, in trade, in dealing with China, and somehow position himself as the good guy in all of that. Yeah. And that is a political skill. So that's what he's pulled off.
Catherine, I'm going to assume you watched parts of or probably most of the Democratic convention, right?
Yep.
What was your sense of how they addressed Vice President Biden's economic plans? To me, it sounded like Joe's going to create jobs. Did you divine more out of it than that?
I think this was not so much about specific policies, right? There were isolated discussions of policies, for example, gun control or immigration. In terms of actual economic policy, I didn't think there was a lot tangibly that came out of the convention events themselves. That's not to say that Biden doesn't have stuff on his website, to be clear. That really wasn't the focus of the last few nights. It was more about character, restoring decency to the White House, that sort of thing. There was discussion about the hardship that Americans were facing, but you didn't hear so much of a plan discussed about how we restore those jobs and and, you know, put people in, put money in people's pockets again.
Right, right. Sudeep, your take on the convention, you know, economic policy wise?
Yeah, the choice that was being presented in this case was, do you want the laissez-faire approach of letting people not wear their masks and letting people go about their business and letting the states figure it out on their own? Or do you want the centralized government approach where you pour more resources into controlling the virus and supporting people on unemployment? All of the things that we've talked about in clean energy and infrastructure and childcare and manufacturing, that is what the Democrats are pitching. And they're pitching it hard. They're saying that government will step in under our approach and take a more active role. That is a hard thing to argue against in this environment when so many people are struggling to just have like the basic normalcy of their lives. Trump will be trying to do that all of next week, painting a darker picture that will come if we go down that road.
Yeah, Catherine, super, super quick on the markets. Two more records today on the various indices. It's all essentially the Fed and plowing money in there and keeping interest rates so low that stocks are relatively attractive, right?
I think that's a large part of it. You also, of course, have optimism about a potential vaccine and animal spirits, for lack of a better term. I think it's that the markets are looking ahead and they're also aware that monetary policy is going to be loose for a very, very long time, which is going to effectively inflate the value of future profits. So, if companies can borrow more cheaply.
Right. Catherine Rempel at the Washington Post, Sudeep Reddy at Politico. Thanks, you two. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a good weekend. On Wall Street on this Friday, I mean, Catherine was just talking about it, right? We'll have some details when we do the numbers. The recession or depression, take your pick, that this pandemic has put us in is different in a couple of ways from recessions and depressions of days past. First of all, it might already technically be over. Technically, of course, doesn't help if you've lost your job and you got to make your mortgage, but the way recessions get measured, it might be done already. Another thing that's different, it's affecting industries that tend to employ women more than industries that tend to employ men. You add that to the disproportionate child care burden that women carry in most families, and this is being called by some a she-cession. And now a new Census Bureau report says more women than men are quitting their jobs to manage that child care. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports.
At the beginning of the year, women's unemployment rate was lower than men's. Then the pandemic hit and the tables have turned. In July, the unemployment rate for women was almost 1% higher, and it's more pronounced for Black and Latina women. Jocelyn Fry is with the Center for American Progress.
Many of the sectors that have seen significant disruption, like leisure and hospitality, restaurants, those are workforces that are often disproportionately female.
And with many schools announcing they are going remote and widespread daycare closures, things are getting even more complicated. Using data from July, the Census Bureau reports women are nearly three times more likely than men to not be working due to COVID-19 related care needs. Valerie Wilson is with the Economic Policy Institute.
I think that is a cultural and social norm that women tend to take on the majority of care responsibilities in a household. And of course, if you live in a household as a single woman with children, then you are the care provider.
Experts are concerned over what effect this will have on the gender wage gap long term. Emily Martin is with the National Women's Law Center.
A big driver of the gender wage gap is the fact that women are more likely to take some time out of the workplace for caregiving. And really what we're seeing in the current recession is that phenomenon, you know, turned up to 11.
She says now, more than ever, is the time for businesses and the government to look into better work-life policies, especially for women. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
One finds on the list of the many, many, many things this pandemic has changed the way we shop for food. More of us are eating at home, obviously. More of us are out of work, too, and having problems paying for the essentials. And with extra unemployment benefits gone and food prices going up, the grocery stores of America are looking at some hard decisions. For shoppers, yes. Also for the stores themselves. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
Despite the economic downturn, many of us are spending more at the grocery store, stocking up in the panic buying days, or just buying more because we're eating at home more. And thanks to expanded federal relief benefits, consumers have been able to pretty much keep buying the types of products they want. But Candace Corlett, president of WSL Strategic Retail, says that's unlikely to continue.
In our numbers, 40% of people were telling us that they were very pessimistic about their finances. But many of them were being supported by a stimulus check or additional weekly unemployment payments. So it delayed the financial crisis.
The downturn has propelled millions of Americans onto SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Joan Driggs, a vice president at analytics firm IRI, who follows the grocery industry, says typically those benefits account for about $100 billion a year in grocery spending.
But with all the increased unemployment, we're looking at an additional like $20 billion increase in SNAP spend coming up.
And in addition to more people using the program, they're using it in different ways. The USDA has expanded the number of states where people can use SNAP to buy groceries online, like at Amazon or Walmart, although delivery fees aren't covered.
The ability to shop with SNAP benefits online really kind of brings that convenience to households that hadn't had that before.
According to the USDA, in March, just 35,000 SNAP households were buying groceries online. In July, it was close to a million. In the meantime, there's additional strain on family budgets. Higher food prices, for one, says Elaine Waxman, a senior fellow at the Urban Institute.
They're probably paying more for the same amount that they were trying to get before. The other thing the families have mentioned to me is that the cost of PPE has typically eaten into their food budget.
Budgets waiting for more federal relief to come in if there's ever a deal. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
Detroit is such an amazing muscle.
And we've got a story from its heart straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go on this Friday. Dow Industrials packed on 190 points, 0.6%, 27,930. NASDAQ added 46 points, 0.4%, finished at 11,311. S&P 500 up 11 points, 0.3%, 33.97, another record finish. Animal spirits, as Catherine said. For the week, the Dow flat, the NASDAQ gained 2.7%, the S&P 500 up 0.7%. You know, we keep seeing evidence surging online sales are helping to offset losses in store sales for some retailers. Today's example comes to us from the accessories and footwear chain The Buckle. Company's online sales nearly doubled for its latest quarter, saw declines from store closures, shares, up more than 18% on a positive earnings report. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. More and more colleges and universities are going all online as the fall semester starts. North Carolina State, Drexel, and Oberlin are the latest. There may be more by the time you hear this because the virus, right? With all that virtual learning, though, come some very real threats, and university IT managers are going all out, warning students and faculty about the biggest vulnerability out there, phishing emails. Marketplace's Scott Tong is on it.
Email hackers impersonate people, and one recent attempt almost duped a cybersecurity prof. At Cedarville University in Ohio, IT professor Phoebe Tsai got an email ostensibly from the bookstore.
That email lists all the courses that I was teaching, the correct matching textbooks. So that notification asked us to pass the links to all our students.
so students could buy their books. But the links were bogus, and thanks to a warning from the actual bookstore, Tsai stood down. When faculty and students do click malicious links, fraudsters can steal personal info and sell it, or hack into databases and pilfer research. Ali Mellon at the security firm Cyber Reason says one enticing email going around now offers students money.
Promising financial aid services, claiming they'll give them student loan forgiveness or they'll pay for the scholarship applications.
With so many students off campus, it's harder to verify suspicious activity in person. And often they log on from outside Protectus campus IT networks. Andrew Cordy is Chief Information Security Officer at Indiana University.
When email is going out to folks at home, we just don't have control over all of those home networks.
Analysts say most email hackers going after students want to make a quick buck, but those targeting faculty may be foreign governments. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
If you need a COVID test, that's covered by insurance. So says federal law. Treatment, though, that's a whole other story. A lot of insurers said at first they would cover the cost of that care. As Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, a lot of those provisions have expired or are about to.
Insurers covering the complete cost of COVID care? That's pretty unusual. Also unusual? A pandemic. Kate Baker, a health economist at the University of Chicago, says that's why many insurers said they'd cover the cost of COVID-19 treatment, because people hesitate to get care when they have to pay. Treatment is valuable to the individual, but
also really valuable for the community because it's a contagious disease.
But insurers covering COVID costs isn't a completely altruistic move, according to Nisha Karani, an analyst with the Kaiser Family Foundation.
Insurers had more cash on hand and had more profits than they expected.
Lots of people skipped out on elective care for months, which meant insurers were spending way less than usual. By covering COVID care, insurers brought up their spending. Now more people are back to seeing their doctors. Rachel Sachs, a law professor at Washington University in St. Louis, says that means insurers now face a difficult financial calculation.
As they think about how much routine care is being foregone and how that relates to the amount of COVID-19 treatments.
A lot of these coverage provisions were already set to expire in May or June. Vanderbilt University health policy professor Stacy Dusitsina says insurers extended them based on what they knew at the time.
We're just kind of guessing about how long these things will last. You know, how long will you need to cover all of the treatments?
Some insurers are planning to extend coverage until it's not a public health emergency. Others may wait until open enrollment starts later this year. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
We've been talking a lot on the show about systemic racism because, well, I mean, it's systemic, right? And that means it shows up everywhere. And by everywhere, I don't just mean hiring practices or housing, but across cities and across zip codes. So with that in mind, a story now from Detroit.
My name is Marcia Music, and I am a writer. I call myself the Detroitist. Detroit is such an amazing muscle. It is a city of transcendent strength, of ability, of work. And the traumas here have been so great. My father was a man by the name of Joe Von Battle. He opened up a record store in 1945 on Old Hastings Street, which was the main thoroughfare of an area called Black Bottom. That street was quite lively and dynamic, particularly in those days. People from nationalities everywhere came to live in Detroit. Detroit is a city of nations. And many of them began their sojourn in the Black Bottom area, particularly immigrants. So I grew up in and around the record shop. We would my mother would send us on chores, sweeping the floors and stacking records and helping dad. But most of the time, what we really did was dance and listen to music. During that period of time, there were all manner of efforts at what they call urban renewal, including the freeway projects. generally, the freeway systems were built through Black neighborhoods that were regarded as expendable or decayed and not worthy of preservation. And Hastings Street was one of those streets that was obliterated by the development of the Chrysler Freeway. So in 1960, my father got the word that he would have to move. Many of the entrepreneurs that were compelled to leave ended up becoming quite prosperous, that the move itself ended up being their springboard. Whereas many of the Black entrepreneurs, particularly because they were restricted spatially and could not move to the suburban areas where these other entrepreneurs were able to plant themselves, they did experience the ending of their businesses. My father was never quite the same once he moved. I believe that that move from Hastings Street to the other area of town, the 12th Street area, marked a real shift in his disease of alcoholism. After his death, I was very overwhelmed with just the years of growing up with an alcoholic parent. And I would run into people who knew him back in his old days. And I would see him maybe at the grocery store, and they would say, you know, your dad was a great man. You really need to write about him. And I just blew it off. But there was a kernel in me that remembered very well when I was a child just how dynamic my father really was. And I remember that record shop and what it really represented.
Marcia took that kernel, she took those memories, and she eulogized them, I guess you might say, in a new poem.
Now look towards old Hastings Street, the place where folks would meet and greet, and businesses sprung up on all its blocks. An avenue of energy and wondrous musicality, and even my own father's record shop. So Hastings was the kind of place both hip and righteous had their space. The sinners and the sanctified, they lived. Reverend C.L. Franklin hooped and squalled, and working girls walked past nightfall, and House of Diggs received all in the end. Aretha Franklin with her dad, the hold they had was ironclad on gospel fans that listened Sunday nights. New Bethel Church, the epicenter, my dad recorded them, remember? And they all three were legends overnight.
That was Marcia Music in Detroit reading a couple of stanzas from her poem, The Bottom, the Valley, and Hastings Street, an elegy in rhyme. And yeah, you heard it right. Her dad, Joe Von Battle, was the guy who recorded the Reverend C.L. Franklin and his daughter, Aretha. Marcia's story was also part of an hour-long Marketplace special that we did about systemic racism in this economy and what the way forward might look like. You can find it at marketplace.org, along with the specials that David did on The Morning Show and Molly did on Marketplace Tech as well. They are all on the Economy What Now page on our website. This final note on the way out today, senators, they are just like us. Delaware Senator Tom Carper sits on the Senate Homeland Security Committee, which held a Zoom hearing today at which Postmaster General Louis DeJoy was the guest of honor. Came Senator Carper's turn to ask questions. He couldn't quite get his Zoom audio to work. We could hear him. He didn't know it. There was some confusion. And as so many of us have done over the past 5 months, he lost it a little bit. He cursed out loud in the hearing. The big curse, the four-letter one, a bunch of times. I mean, I feel for him, you know? Okay, we are out on a Friday. Here is your moment of economic context to take into the weekend. It's the real estate division today. We've talked a lot about how the pandemic is changing things, right? Just today with Kimberly and food. Another thing, where we want to live, literally where. We learned this morning existing home sales, previously owned is another way to say that. They were up 25% in July. That is huge. The biggest monthly jump dating back to 1968. A logical conclusion. We are spending all this time at home staring at the four walls. We want to stare at something different, right? Okay, we are actually going now. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.